KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
SoMa.
I'm from Berkeley.
Concord, Cali.
Tenderloin District.
La Mission.
The Mission District.
Coming up, we'll hear what it will mean if the governor adds a new gender designation on driver's licenses.
This change is important because gender nonconforming people, they feel like they're the ultimate authorities on their own gender.
Male, female, or X. Then, does the San Francisco Zoo have plans in place for natural disasters, like tsunamis?
If we have some time, we will secure all our animals within their habitats and we'll have everybody head to high ground.
And we'll hear what it means when the status of an endangered species changes.
We don't change our course of action, really, whether it's endangered or vulnerable.
That story and more today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Californians might have more options than just M for male or F for female on their driver's licenses soon, if Governor Brown signs a bill on his desk into law in the next few weeks. The bill would add a third option that's neither male nor female on driver's licenses and other state documents. It'll also make changing your gender on documents easier. KALW health reporter Marissa Ortega-Welch joins me to discuss the decision. So this bill is called the Gender Recognition Act. Tell us more about it.
It's sort of a small bill, but it will have a big impact for some people. And I also think symbolically, it's a pretty big deal. So it does two big things. The first thing it does is it gets rid of the requirement for a doctor's letter if you want to have a court-ordered gender change. Mm. Okay, so right now, let's say you're a transgender man, but you were assigned female at birth. So you might have this letter F for female on your driver's license, and you might want to change that to an M to match the fact that you're a man. Mm-hmm. Right now, if you want to petition the court to do that, you would need a doctor's letter certifying that you'd undergone a gender transition. This bill would get rid of that requirement. You wouldn't need a doctor's letter anymore. You just have to swear under penalty of perjury that you are who you say you are, and then you just apply for the change. People under the age of 18 would still need a letter of permission from their parents.
Okay, so are there people opposing this bill?
There's definitely been some opposition to the bill, but it's coming from places that you might expect, like conservative religious groups. And they are bringing up a concern of identity fraud, that maybe if you can change your gender, you can somehow commit some sort of identity fraud. Mm-hmm. Proponents of the bill, though, say that they're using that as an excuse when really what they have issue with is the issue of people changing their gender at all. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, your name and photo are really a much better way to verify who you are than that letter M or F on your driver's license. Mm-hmm. This change is important because transgender people, gender nonconforming people, they feel like they're the ultimate authorities on their own gender. They shouldn't have to have a doctor weigh in on what is ultimately their decision. It can also be time-consuming and difficult to access a doctor and adds what they see as an unnecessary step.
Okay, so you said the bill does two things. What's the other thing?
Well, the other thing is, some people maybe don't want to choose between male or female on their driver's license or birth certificate because they don't identify as either. The bill would require state documents, like driver's license, like birth certificates, to have a third option, what's called a non-binary gender option, mm-hmm. meaning neither male nor female.
So not one of those two choices, like the binary of man and woman.
Exactly. More and more people, especially young people, are no longer identifying with either gender of man or woman. It's difficult to quantify how many people identify as a non-binary gender because it hasn't been a category on survey forms, so we haven't been able to collect any data on that. The LGBT advocacy group GLAAD did a survey, and they found that 12% of millennials don't identify as cisgender, meaning they don't identify as the gender that is listed on their birth certificate, okay. that they were assigned at birth.
12%, that is a lot.
It is. And that's why I think this bill is symbolically important, because it's really recognizing that there are all these other gender identities outside of that binary or of man or woman. Mm-hmm. Some of the language in the bill is pretty radical. I want to read you a couple of the lines. It says, the binary gender designations of female and male fail to adequately represent the diversity of human experience. And it says, gender identification is fundamentally personal, and the state should endeavor to provide options on state-issued identification documents that recognize a person's accurate gender identification.
That's in the bill.
That is in the bill.
So what would this look like on a driver's license? Will it say non-binary gender? What will it say?
Yeah, what it actually looks like is still to be determined. And it's left up to the DMV, the Department of Motor Vehicles, and the state registrar to figure out what it will look like on driver's license and birth certificates. But Washington, D.C. and Oregon have already passed similar laws that went into effect this summer. And they use the letter X to symbolize non-binary gender.
So you can check male, female, or the X.
Yeah, exactly. And X doesn't necessarily represent a gender within itself. It's not like a third gender. It's just neither male or female. The bill recognizes that people could have a whole list of gender identities outside of man or woman, like agender, genderqueer, gender fluid, or two-spirit. So the X would be a stand-in for, you know, what could be all these other options.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just other states that already are using this X. Other countries do it too, Australia and New Zealand.
So when would we expect to see these changes then?
Well, so if Governor Brown signs the bill into law, and he is expected to sign the bill, it will go into effect January 2019. So we have a while to wait.
Okay. Thanks, Marissa.
Yeah. Thank you, Hannah.
Marissa Ortega-Welch is KALW's health reporter. You can reach her at health@KALW.org. We wanted to hear from people with a stake in the governor's non-binary gender designation decision, so we sent KALW's Asal Ehsanipour and Zaina Nasser to see what folks had to say.
I'm trans feminine. I have they, them pronouns. I'm from New York, and I've been about a year in the Bay. I'm scared that, like, we get too much into, like, bureaucratically defining ourselves, putting ourselves onto forms, and those changes then being really hard to update and to move, slash also sapping a lot of energy out of, like, so much of the work that we really have to do to, like, heal. X is fine. As with anything, like, we're not going to get a form that encapsulates all of humanity, right? And that doesn't mean we shouldn't try, but it also means we should be realistic.
I mean, I feel like anyone should be able to self-identify as whatever they want, and I fail to see the purpose of needing a gender marker on things like ID. If you're traveling or getting pulled over, I don't see how gender identity has anything to do with that. That being said, people who have been misgendered their whole life and want to be able to choose how people are seeing them should have the option of choosing what gender marker they're using.
In my ideal world, the state would not be identifying folks in their gender given at birth. And I think that given a third gender identity still limits us to live within a binary that, in my opinion, does not exist in terms of gender. And it does place non-binary folks within another binary that, at least for me, I'm trying to escape and have been trying to escape my whole life.
This is actually really cool that this is happening now, because it's what I've been waiting for. I opted not to change my name to match my gender identity a few years ago, mainly because I knew there wasn't going to be a easy way to reflect who and what I actually am. And my gender marker also reflects that. But now having the option, that's when this goes into effect, I can actually go forward with this process.
The voices you heard were Binia Coats, Adrian Susio, E. Schwartz, and Gabrielle Valentine. They were recorded by KALW's Zaina Nasser and Asal Ehsanipour. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. The devastation from Hurricanes Irma, Harvey, and Maria impacted the lives of people and animals. As the waters rose, some owners left their pets behind. Various reports say the storm displaced thousands of pets. So if escaping a storm with just a pet is difficult, how do zoos prepare for natural disasters? One listener contacted us through Hey Area. That's where you ask questions about the Bay Area and our reporters find the answers. Hurricanes don't tear through the Bay Area, but this listener wanted to know what the plan was for the San Francisco Zoo in case of a tsunami. The zoo is right across Ocean Beach. So we sent reporter Janae Darden to the zoo for answers.
It's fairly quiet when I walk through the entrance of the San Francisco Zoo. That is until...
Those are the lemurs. We have a lemur forest which has 8 species of lemurs in it. They're all males, so they don't fight, but they do kind of say, hey, you know, we're over here, where are you?
Joe Fitting is the deputy director of the San Francisco Zoo. The lemurs live in a big open area dotted with trees and tall jungle gym structures, surrounded by a little moat. The zoo itself is right across the road from a much bigger body of water, the ocean. So what happens if there's a tsunami and the ocean water floods the zoo?
The city has tsunami warning horns. If we have some time, we will secure all our animals within their habitats, enclosures, and we'll have everybody head to high ground.
And what's the point of securing the animals?
For public safety. I mean, we don't want some sort of dangerous animal getting out into the general population.
There are more than 1,000 animals on the zoo's grounds. And in the event of a big tsunami, when it comes to their safety...
Well, there's not much we can do. I mean, we can... Certainly a lot of these buildings are enclosed and have walls and doors and stuff like that.
Many zoos have policies to not evacuate animals for their own protection. In an interview during Hurricane Irma, Ron McGill, an official from Zoo Miami, tells MSNBC why.
To move them off ground is so stressful to these animals that potentially in and of itself could kill them.
And thankfully, Zoo Miami's animals survived Irma. Storm bunkers kept the animals safe. During Hurricane Harvey, Houston zookeepers slept in storm-safe buildings with the animals. Kevin Hodge tells KHOU News.
Slept in the bug house. So I was in there with the roaches and the walking sticks and that kind of thing. But I was safe in there.
Of course, here in San Francisco, we don't experience hurricanes. But the zoo animals will probably be safer in their cages during a tsunami.
We're about 50 feet off of the sea level up on top of a sand dune looking down on the waves. And because of that height and because it gets higher ground above us, the chance of significant damage here is pretty low.
Christina Rule and I are right across the street from the zoo at a very windy ocean beach. She's a researcher at UC Berkeley's Seismological Laboratory. We can see the zoo from the beach.
And the distance that the water might run on shore is not very far. But there is a chance that we may get tsunamis here. In the 1906 earthquake, there was a tsunami in this area, but again, it didn't run on shore very far in this area.
Rural says a few of our West Coast neighbors are at a greater risk for tsunamis.
In areas like Cascadia, which encompasses the states of Oregon and Washington, there's a subduction zone fault offshore, and that can create much larger tsunamis.
And what's this? You said a subduction zone?
A subduction zone is a type of fault. So in California, most of our faults are strike.
Basically, in subduction zones, one plate rides over another plate, which causes the water to move more. Rule says most of our faults in California are strike slip, where plates move in a sideways motion past each other. A fun and easy way to understand this? Take a bath.
When you put your hand through like a shark fin and just pushed it, it would go through the water relatively easy and not create a bunch of waves. But if you put it flat and lifted your palm up, you would create a lot of displacement of water, and that's kind of like a tsunami.
Back at the zoo, Joe Fitting and I walk past families pushing their babies in strollers. Nearby, a group of lemurs climb up a post and cuddle together in their forest. It's hard to imagine a tsunami in this serene moment. Fitting says they're prepared for all sorts of emergencies.
Public safety is our number one priority, and the safety of our animal collection and our staff.
For now, at least, the 1,000 or so animals of the San Francisco Zoo remain safe and dry. In San Francisco, I'm Janae Darden for Cross Currents.
That story is part of Hey Area, KALW's collaborative reporting project. If you've got a question for Hey Area, you can submit it at our website, kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Our next story is about one of the residents of the San Francisco Zoo, the snow leopard. The species had been officially listed as endangered since 1972, but last month it was reclassified as vulnerable by the International Union for Conservation of Nature. So what does that mean for the survival of those big cats? To learn more, KALW's Ben Trefney reached Rodney Jackson. He's founder and director of the Snow Leopard Conservancy based in Sonoma, California. He was part of the classification committee, and he's been working to protect the animals for over three decades.
There are two criteria that have to be met in order for an endangered classification to be provided. The first one is that the global population must consist of fewer than 2,500 mature adults. The second, that there should be an ongoing decline of 20% over 16 years, and that 16 years is judged to be a two generations of snow leopard life. So you look back 16 years and you do an assessment of what you think the decline rate is, obviously broadly, because data is often lacking, as it is in this case, and we have to base it on the best knowledge that we had. As you can imagine, surveying a cat that is very rarely seen, that lives above 10,000 feet generally, as high as 18 or 19,000 feet in extremely rugged terrain, is not an easy task. And it's going to take many years, I think, before we have a good, scientifically robust population estimate.
Well, and this is called the ghost cat because of its elusiveness and because it's so hard to find.
Exactly. It's really only recently, I would say in the last two decades, that I've had regular sightings of the cat. And all those sightings, without exception, have occurred in areas where the community has become actively involved in the conservation of the species.
So this has been cause for a lot of people to be very happy for the change of status. I'm wondering then, what does the change of status really mean for a species? Can you look to other species whose status has been changed from endangered to vulnerable, and what that's meant for their population and for the conservation groups who have fought for their survival?
That's a good question, because not many species have been changed recently, I think in large part because the assessment process was somewhat subjective, and now that it's becoming more tied to global standards, I think we're going to have more of these sort of changes occurring. The one that comes to mind most prominently, I guess, is the giant panda from China. So that was endangered, and last year an assessment was done, and it was upgraded to vulnerable, or some people say downlisted, to vulnerable, the lower category. And it was done on the basis of number of animals and also especially the rate of change. So the Chinese have done a good job with protecting the habitat and securing, protected areas, working with local people so that the forests aren't cut down and the bamboo stands remain. I think that's a very good example of a situation where a change in status actually is a positive news, and it's not led to the government saying, oh, okay, we don't have to worry about it anymore. In fact, they've doubled their efforts, and they really secured that population.
But that is part of the concern, that once the status changes, then perhaps protections would not be as strong, or even perhaps the donor base that helps support some of these conservation efforts might lose attention to this and put its attention on more endangered species. I would imagine that's a concern for you leading an organization like Snow Leopard Conservancy.
Yeah, you know, I see it actually more from a positive viewpoint. I think it's a success, and I think we should be advertising our successes. We should not let up, of course. We still have to deal with threats that exist out there, and in some cases increasing or changing. We don't know what the future might be in 5 or 10 years. We can make a guess, but it's totally a guess. And the Red List obviously has to be based more on real evidence. So I would say that it's, you know, we don't change our course of action, really, whether it's endangered or vulnerable.
That was Rodney Jackson, founder and director of the Snow Leopard Conservancy, speaking with KALW's Ben Trefney. You can hear a longer version of their interview at our website, kalw.org, and click Cross Currents. We're going to end today's show with the last of our week-long series from our partners at Stories Behind the Fog, a multimedia project that puts human faces on the problem of homelessness. Brianna Johnson was homeless and struggling to remain in school. When she found the Life Learning Academy on Treasure Island in San Francisco, fellow students gave her shelter, and its principal, Terry Delane, helped her through difficult years.
They were my friends, and they housed me during the times that my mom wouldn't or the times that I was kicked out. So I would sleep on their couch, and if it wasn't available because they were sleeping in their parents' house, so if I couldn't go to their homes, then I would ride BART, just ride the BART train all night until 12 o'clock, and then I would catch like late-night buses that were running all night so that I can just stay on the bus and stay warm and so forth. In this school, this was my getaway. Every time I came here, guaranteed I was either in that back office over there or in that office before and after class, just so that I could have an outlet to talk about the things that I was going through, because it's hard to try to maintain and go to school and worry about where you're gonna lay your head after school. That's hard, so. I've noticed that when I was not going to the school, anything that affected me affected everything in my life, literally. It affected everything in my life because this place was home for me. So that's what I'm saying. If a kid has a home, you have somewhere where you feel comfortable, you will be successful, you will succeed. You're gonna be able to do whatever it is you want to do because you have that home and you feel loved. So me having a home, being able to eat, if I needed to take a shower, I could take a shower. If I wanted to lay down, there was a couch right there. Terry would let me take a nap. It was some days where I just wasn't feeling it, and Terry would be like, you know what, come in this office, go lay down, or come talk to me, cry it out, get it off your chest, and go back to class. Terry told me about just straight up how dumb the decisions that I was doing, how dumb it was, what it was going to lead me to, and just straight up asked me, do I want to change? What do you want to do? And that from then I had to think and figure out, what do you want to do? Like, what does Brianna want to do? Does Brianna want to sell drugs? Does Brianna want to smoke drugs? Does Brianna want to be a drug addict? What does Brianna want? And I decided I want to change, and that's what it was. The space that I am today, I see myself flourishing how I should have been. I've always had it in me, that's who I am. So that's what I see. I see me progressing to the woman that I've been destined to be, with nothing holding me back anymore. Not a partner, not a housing situation, not weed, not worrying about the world, you know, what the world consists of, and worrying about pleasing the world. I'm not that Brianna anymore. I'm focused right now. That's where I am. I'm very focused. I want to give back because the issues that I've
experience growing up. I don't want anybody. I know it's going to be a kid out there who goes through it, but I'd rather, like what Terry's doing, I'd rather that be opening up as soon as possible so that nobody has to leave here or anywhere and wonder where they're going to go. Like, I just feel like no kid should ever, ever, ever feel like that. We were brought into this world. I feel like we should never have to fend for ourselves. There's too many adults, there's too many people around us to feel alone. So that's what I want to do.
Brianna's story was produced by KALW's Zoe Liu. It's an excerpt from Stories Behind the Fog, Humanizing Homelessness in San Francisco, One Story at a Time. We've been airing them all this week. You can find this and other stories, plus photography from the project, at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. And that's all for the show today. The Cross Currents team includes Marisol Medina Cadena, Nina Gensler Debs, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega Welch, Stephen Short, Jackie Sajiko, Andrew Stelzer, Bo Walsh, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley Ma. The managing editor is Jen Chien. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is from The Flamenco Show, produced by Carolina Lugo and Carole Acuña. Their ballet flamenco show takes place Saturday at the Peña Pachamama Center. That's in San Francisco's North Beach neighborhood, and reservations are highly recommended. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.